is an extraordinarily bleak view that those of us who are informed have of the future of mankind. We by humans have done everything feasible to negate opportunity, to negate prosperity, to negate self-reliance, to promote religion, to promote militancy, invasions, police states, unjust justice systems, such that we recognize that there's a reason that God, whose name is Yahweh, specifically asked the first man who would model the terms and conditions as well as the benefits of his covenant, first and foremost, as a prerequisite to walk away from his country. His country was Babylon. The prophet Yirmiyah, writing principally to Gentiles, tells us that Babylon models the Christian religion with its celebration of Christmas and Easter, its Sunday worship, its popularity based upon lies. God even goes into great detail in the prophet Habakkuk to tell us that Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, was the plague of death. He does everything he can to tell us that we should not be religious. He also tells us we should not be political, also describing the nature of the political influences in our world. In fact, Yahusha, while sailing with his disciples, specifically said that the yeast that is being removed by matzah, which is the second of seven invitations to meet with God and be called out of the world of politics and religion, he said that the very definition, the essence of this fungus, this yeast that is being removed from us on matzah, is religion and politics. It is terrible, tragic, disingenuous, deceitful, destructive, deadly, what we have done to one another. You know, in the name of peace, we make great armies, great militaries, kill vast amounts of people. In the name of freedom, we imprison 1% of our population. In the name of justice, we run incredibly unjust legal charades. In the name of politics, we declare war against tactics and yet praise the enemies that are actually inspiring the attacks. We've made a mess of things. And the reason that God has asked us to disassociate from these things is because he doesn't want any of them in his home. If God were to say that everybody was welcome in heaven who was political and religious, who was praise our troops and God bless our troops and God bless our country and believe that your freedom is a result of the sacrifice and the service of those who engage in the military, and that you are protected by the first responders, the police, and that your government owes you its retirement through Social Security, and that health care is not a privilege but a right. If you're among those, and God were to say to you, hey, come on in into heaven, then how would heaven be any different than the hell we experience here on earth? Be the same. Wouldn't be a benefit going to heaven. It'd be just a continuation of the same. In fact, it'd be far worse because there'd be no end to it. So God has said explicitly that you can do whatever you want. If you want to be religious, be religious. If you want to be political, be political. If you want to be militaristic. Just know, you aren't dragging any of that into my home. You aren't coming into my home being religious or political. I'm not going to embrace lies or liars. Now, if you want and you're willing to recognize that man's political and religious schemes are counterproductive, they are not reliable, and you want to distance yourself from them, and you'd like to form a relationship with me, getting to know me as I am, coming to understand the terms and conditions of my covenant, my family-oriented relationship, and you want to participate in my covenant and be part of my family, only five terms and conditions, the first of which is to walk away from politics and religion. If you're willing to do that, you're willing to trust and rely on Yahweh instead of human institutions, if you're willing to walk to God along the path He has provided, beginning at Passover and then Matzah and Bukkotim to become perfect, He is willing to perfect you. If you're willing to observe, which means to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of His covenant and engage in them, act upon them, then you will receive all of its benefits. If you're willing to demonstrate tangibly your signature on His covenant, your commitment to raise your children to be God's children, you're welcome. If not, you're not. You can choose your choice, religion or covenant. One leads to death, the other to life. But it is your choice. Now, speaking of His nature, what He is offering, what you can count on and not, as we were considering this Barashi testimony of what happened after the fall, after Adam and Chawa chose to disregard Yah's testimony, just as every Christian does today. There's no Christian today that is Torah observant. And since they disregard Yah's guidance in His Torah, there isn't a single Christian that's engaged in the covenant relationship that is part of God's family. And God has said, Yahweh said, my spirit will not remain in, contend with, or plead with mankind for an unlimited duration of time. In fact, folks, the maximum time that you have left, if you are religious and political, and you want instead to disengage from your religion or from your political preference, and you wish to participate in a relationship with Yahweh, the maximum time you have left is 20 years. And so God is saying, I'm not going to continue to have an open invitation. You've got 20 years left. Also, as a result of mankind being flesh, His day shall be limited to 120 years. For those who choose to be religious, whether no matter what the religion is, no matter if it's Christianity or Judaism or Islam or socialist secular humanism or Hinduism or Buddhism, doesn't matter. If you choose to be religious, the maximum amount of time that you're going to live is 120 years, at which time your flesh will rot, decay, and your consciousness, your nefesh, your soul, will cease to exist. That's how much time you have at the very most. And if you're well into those years, then your time is more limited still. Now, prior to the flood, the water vapor shield, which Yah spoke about in Bereshith 2:6, at least in this place and in this time, it would have precluded the sun's most damaging rays from eroding the elasticity of our cells. This, combined with a less disease-ridden and degraded genome, would have enabled the perfectly designed humans who emerged from the garden to live for a very long time. But that was all about to end. True to His word, from this time forward, 120 years became the maximum extent of a human life. And that number, a maximum of 120 years, is also important prophetically. Yahweh will go on to say that the generation which experiences the Holocaust, as presented in the 102nd Psalm, will be the last generation. In Matthew 24, He says that those who experience the return of Yisrael to the land will also witness His return. So the most you can add to the 1932 beginnings of the Holocaust, to the 1948 return of Yisrael's to the land, is 120 years. And that would mean that 2068 is the absolute last day. So all we have to figure is there a Yobel year? Because everything that God does that's important happened on Yobel years. Is there a Yobel year? A matter of Yobel years every 50 years, 7 times 7 plus 1. Is there a Yobel year within the 120 years from the time that Israel became a nation, the time of the Holocaust, that lies before us within that 120-year window. And there is 2033. And come to find out, 2033 is exactly 40 yovel from the fulfillment of the first Moed Mikre, from Yosha's fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavua in 33 CE. 40 yovel, 40 times 50 is 2,000 years. And wouldn't you know, it's exactly that date in 33 CE, year 4,000 Yah, is exactly 40 yovel from the time that Yahweh and Abraham affirmed the covenant on Mount Moriah. And that date was exactly 40 yovel from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden for ignoring Yah's testimony, his guidance. That's the plan. It's etched in stone. And with 2033 being year 6,000 Yah, when he will return, the last yovel year within the 120-year lifespan of those who witnessed the Holocaust, who witnessed the return of Israelites to Yisrael. With 2033 being the only yovel year within that time span, we are at very most 20 years from the end of life on earth as we know it. Now, 20 years from now, things are going to get much better. But between now and then, they're going to get much worse. We're going to endure a horrible tribulation. It will begin in the fall of 2026. And between now and then, things will continue to degrade. But then, in 2033, year 6,000 Yah, right on schedule, Yahweh will not only return, and the whole world will see his return all at once, but in the 5 days between Yom Kippurim, the day of his return, to Sukkah, where we will all get to camp out with God, he is going to restore the entire earth to the conditions that were enjoyed in the Garden of Great Joy and the Garden of Eden. That is his plan. You can count on it. Now, as we move through the text, we're next going to find that an errant rendering of Nephilim in the next statement is almost always translated to infer that giants were living on the earth. I can only assume that the Latin scholars who did this, who misconveyed the meaning of Nephilim, missed the religious connotations and assumed that physical prowess would be the only reason to mention such people. So as we continue on with Yah's testimony and Bereshit, in the beginning, Genesis 6:4, we read the Nephilim. Because this is a proper noun, I'm just going to transliterate the term. I'll define it here in a moment for you. The Nephilim existed in the land in that day and also afterward. Nephilim is the plural of Nephal. Y-M denotes plural in Hebrew. So it's the plural of Nephal. Nephal means those who prostrate themselves, those who have fallen away, those who are oppressed, cast down, and who die. There's nothing remotely giant about it. Now, if you read it in English translation, because they're all regurgitated versions of the Latin Vulgate, you'll read the giants in the land in that day. But no, it says the Nephilim. Nephilim would be those who prostrate themselves, those who have fallen away, those who are oppressed, cast down, and die, existed in the land in that day, in that time, Yom, and also afterward, Akar. From the beginning, Satan's religions have all had his victims bowing down. You know, if you're bowing down in a religious environment, you're bowing down to the Lord, who is a guise for Satan. Satan wants man to worship him as God. He wants to be God. He wants to be seen as God. And so all religions have individuals prostrate. The most satanic of religions, Islam, has its minions prostrate themselves to Allah, who is Satan, multiple times a day, mooning God while groveling one's face in the dirt to Satan. And it's a signature of religions, the signature of what Satan wants. It's the literal manifestation of the qualities desired by a Lord. It's why God never refers to himself as the Lord. Why he refers to himself as the Father. There's no worship. There's no bowing down in a family setting. As a result of having ignored Yahweh and his word, out of apathy, ignorance, and or convenience, many people, and the Nephilim were symbolic of this, became victimized by religion. They were oppressed in this life and either die or cast down in the next. That is the result. Today, read Ahar at a later time, the people best known for their repetitive prostrations are, of course, Muslims. That is significant because Naphish was also the second-to-last son of Ishmael, which is Islam's patriarch. And as you might suspect, the Naphish were an Arabian tribe. That is not to say that Islam, the Arabic word for submission, isn't new. Satan has been corrupting men for a long time. His favorite strategy remains to present himself as God. It is the essence of the terrorist chant, Allahu Akbar. Allah is greater. Allah is greatest. Or so this fallen messenger wants fallen man to believe. So anyway, what we're talking about here is not giants, but men who are coward, bowing down to the adversary, to the very one who deceived them, who led them away from God. And indeed, relationally, the sons of God came to and pursued, bowed, babo, were included in association with the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These men-ish male individuals were renowned for Shem, were named for, had a reputation for magnifying themselves, going off to war, and acting like arrogant tyrants, Yibor, from the very beginning, Olam, for a very long time. Barishith in the beginning, 6:4. So in this statement, Yahweh has transitioned from calling men Adam to calling them Ish because he is now viewing them differently. They are no longer sons of Adam, which was the first man modeled in God's image, to becoming just individuals, Ish. Changes. This change is the difference between how God views us. In Barishith 10:8, we are told that the father of politicized religion, of human self-aggrandizement, Nimrod, was a Gibor. So it's not a compliment. Arrogant, self-aggrandizing men have used a caustic blend of religion and politics to start wars and to set themselves up as tyrannical despots for a very, very long time. It's the hallmark of human behavior. The thing we are best known for. If I were asked to consolidate human history into a single word, it might well be Gibor. The story of men magnifying themselves, going off to war, and behaving like arrogant tyrants. Well, that's not the individual preference. It certainly is the preference of those who write our history, who carry out the worst aspects of human history. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. We have made a mess of things, that's humankind, through religion and politics, through the advent of militaries. But the advent of religion, of militaries, of political schemes, all of which arose at the outskirts of what was the Garden of Eden. If you follow the history of humankind, you'll find them along the shores of the Black Sea. You'll find them all the way down in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Remember that Eden was at the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and therefore this onslaught of mixing religion and politics and militarism together, which we witness today in America, but was ubiquitous back at 4000 BCE, immediately after the fall and for 1,000 years thereafter. Well, God saw what man did through religion and politics, through militarism and economic schemes, and he said that indeed the evil intent, the wickedness and depravity of mankind in the land, in the region, was great in magnitude and quantity, Rob, and that his every inclination, yes, sir, his motivation, desire, ambition of his heart and his thoughts were bad, were raw, evil, wicked, immoral, repugnant, miserable, troubling, and harmful all of the time. Kol Yom. It's quite an indictment. I would say that indictment is true today, that we are every bit as bad as was the groups of people down through the Tigris and Euphrates Valley around the Black Sea, the outskirts of now walled off the Garden of Eden. And so if you read this in the present tense, and Hebrew, by the way, allows that, because when it says Yahweh saw, and we take that as past tense, you know, there is no past tense in Hebrew, there is no future tense in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the language does not convey time. What God says was true is true and will always be true. So Yahweh saw past tense. He will see future tense. He sees present tense. That indeed, the evil intent, the wickedness, and the depravity, the rot, the deprivation, the distress, the misfortune of mankind, of Adam, in the land, in the region, Har Eretz, was great in magnitude and quantity, Rob, was prolific and abundant, and his every inclination, our motivations, desires, ambitions of our hearts and thoughts, Leb and Mashabah, plans, plots, purposes, and schemes were raw, evil, immoral, repugnant, miserable, harmful, kol, yom, all of the time. You know, it only takes a spark to get a fire raging, and all too suddenly, every good thing is consumed in it. By this time, man had used his nesama so poorly, creation had been for naught. There was virtually no one open to knowing Yahweh, to engaging in a relationship with Yahweh. The entire purpose for creation had been extinguished by Hasatan. Mankind was now evil, depraved. His every inclination and thought was immoral and repugnant, miserable and troubling all of the time. Nesham, in the following statement, is one of those words which the context of the sentence is required to properly convey its meaning. It can depict being consoled and encouraged after finding relief from sorrow and distress, but it can also infer to reconsider changing one's opinion, leading to sorrow, but being sorry, to suffering grief and experiencing regret, based upon the situation which had developed and upon the subsequent use of atzab in the text conveying pain and distress. I suspect that the meaning is quite clear. Then Yahweh truly grieved, regretting Nesham that he had made, that he had acted upon and engaged with Ashah, fashioned and created Adam, along with the earth. His heart, Leb, was emotionally distressed, filled with grief and sorrow. Atzab was hurt, pained, vexed, displeased, and tormented. It's one of the reasons that God has chosen a mechanism where he only knows those who seek to know him. He does not know those who are engaged in religion. When a religious person prays to him, he doesn't hear them. When a religious person goes into a church or a mosque, he does not see them. When armies march off to war in his name, he knows nothing of them. God has precluded himself from seeing that which is painful and harmful, because otherwise creation would be counterproductive. God knows those who seek to know him. He enjoys their company. But as Yahweh looked around the landscape at humankind, he realized that there was one man in his family that made an honest effort to know him, that wanted to engage in a relationship with him, and that all of the other population of this planet, particularly those with an Asama, those living in Mesopotamia, where man's first religious and political schemes emerged, that they were just miserable, rotten, that there wasn't anything about them that was positive, and so God just looked at mankind and said, why did I make this mess? This is incredibly sad. There's nothing here to enjoy. And if you think that today's society, rife as we are with political and religious corruptions of all magnitudes and mighty militaries that kill, maim, destroy, that God is looking at the earth today and saying, boy, isn't it just wonderful? Look how wonderful all these people are, particularly all these people being religious, ignoring everything I said and praying to their Lord, doing exactly the opposite of my guidance. And he would say, boy, that is really heinous. So God just chooses in most cases to ignore them. But at this particular time, he couldn't. And the reason he couldn't ignore all of this was that if he did not intervene at this point and make a fresh start with a family and their Nesama that sought to know him, then there would be no hope for humankind. We would destroy ourselves and our planet faster than Yahweh could reconcile our relationship with him. He had a plan that was going to play out over 6,000 years on his schedule, honoring the 6 days that he had set apart for us to walk to him, walk away from all of this corruption. And those events, the first of them was 1,000 years hence when he would codify and affirm the covenant with Abraham. And then 3,000 years later, to 40 Yobel after the covenant was formed with Abraham, that he was going to enable its benefits through Yahusha himself in diminished form, fulfilling the first four Moed Mikre. And he was now 5,000 years before his ultimate reconciliation with humankind in his return. So it was a long time. And if mankind was not checked, if the growth of religion and politics and militaries and evil, malignant behavior was not thwarted and we did not get a fresh start, we never would have survived that long. We would have destroyed life and the planet long before then. And so Yahweh had to act. So here is God saying, then Yahweh truly grieved, regretting that he had made Adam along with the earth. His heart was emotionally distressed, filled with grief and sorrow. This tells us that God can and does experience regret. It's important because it demonstrates that we are not victimized by predestination. The future is not predetermined if we still choose our fate. And it means that we can and do choose poorly. We are free to do things God does not want us to do, is what this says. God did not micromanage the solution. He did not cause touchdowns. He did not cause strikeouts. He did not cause the Molly and Joe to meet each other and fall in love and get married through Christian mingle. God allowed humankind free will, and we chose poorly, and God did not intervene. The fact that God experiences grief tells us that for him, love and relationships are very real. Life is not a game. But more than anything, this statement reveals that Yahweh is engaged, that he cares deeply about and personally about the souls who seek to know him, because he wants us to know him, to choose to be with him, to choose to love him. And thus far, that plan is not going very well. Very few people had made that choice, but yet for those very few people, he would still protect them. He would go out of his way, because love must hate. For God to love those, the few that were seeking to know him, he must be opposed to those who were making that virtually impossible for everyone else. If you do not despise that which is harmful to those you love, then your love is not genuine. And this is the case of God. So while he very seldom intervenes in human affairs at this time, that was the only way to protect his children. There are two vastly different ways to render Bereshit 6:7, because men means from and because, and the Hebrew word all can be translated mighty one, on, continuously, prey upon, or forever. Most English translations render it as to, and then suggest that the Lord wants to blot out animals, creeping things, and birds in addition to man. Since that doesn't make any sense, I've chosen because to represent men, which is a common translation of it, and continuously prey upon as the most rational rendering of all in this context. None of this means that I'm smarter, more scholastic, or a better linguist than other translators, because I'm not. But given the choice between rational and irrational, between consistent and inconsistent, I've elected to render Yah's word in a manner which makes the most sense in context, being true to the terms that God chose, while at the same time delivering a result which is in harmony with his nature. And I've made a point of providing you with the Hebrew terms which form the basis of the translations that I shared. You can go in this particular case to yadayah.com and find this written for you, and you can do your own investigation, and I would encourage you to do so. So Yahweh said, I will eliminate, Masah, I will obliterate and destroy, I will annihilate and exterminate the Adam, the man, whom relationally I have created from the presence of the ground, because the Adam man has preyed upon living creatures who move about and winged creatures who fly in the sky. Indeed, because I am grieved, regretting having made them. Bereshith, in the beginning, Genesis 6-7. In the last segment of our program today, we will analyze this statement from God. So as we consider in Genesis 6-7, Bereshith, in the beginning, so Yahweh said, didn't say the Lord says, it says Yahweh said, I will eliminate, mana, obliterate, destroy, and annihilate and exterminate, wipe out and terminate the existence of, and cleanse and remove the impurity of Adam, man, whom relationally I have created, bara, conceived and fashioned, bringing into existence. The first part of that is interesting to know, because in religions like Islam and Christianity, it is said that everyone either goes to heaven or hell. In other words, souls are immortal, and one's immortal soul is either punished in hell or rewarded in heaven. And that's just not the case. Yahweh, who created life, said that our souls are temporal, that they are mortal, and that the life which he conceived, he gave us life that was mortal, that had a fuse on it, that a time limit to it, and that the vast majority of human souls, like animal souls, they cease to exist. They are annihilated. They are exterminated, wiped out, terminated at the end of their mortal existence. And it's not so much an active thing in the sense of we consider the word to obliterate or and to annihilate, causing a soul to cease to exist. It's more of a passive thing whereby the souls that do not use their nesama to come to know Yahweh or embrace the terms and conditions of his covenant, as a result of not knowing God and of not seeking the means to immortality and perfection and adoption into his family, they just simply cease to exist. And so that is what God is saying here. And it's the majority of human souls that just cease to exist. And it's ultimately fair. In fact, it's better than fair. God gave us the gift of mortal life. He gave us this nesama, or this conscience to exercise good judgment, and he gave us free will to act upon it. And then he gave us his Torah, revealing his nature and his offer. Extraordinary fair. And the consequence of choosing to ignore what he had to say is just that you cease to exist. No punishment, no pain. No torture, ultimately fair. And so for God to say, you know, I'm going to see to it that the majority of human life is extinguished, was his that he gave. You know, it's like the people that complain, you know, there's been a modest cutback in the SNAP program or food stamps. And now it's a credit card as opposed to stamps, and it's like the people that received those that gift that was undeserved, that when it's forestalled and someone says, you know, I gave you $10,000 worth of food stamps, but I'm not going to give you the 11,000 dollars, that somehow something is being taken away and that's harsh and cruel and uncaring. No, the fact that you got $10,000 for nothing, or 70 years of life, or 120 years of life, and that you're not getting the 121st year is not mean. It's not inappropriate, particularly if you're the one that is gave the life in the first place. And so God is saying, you know, I'm not going to continue to allow humans to live that are doing nothing but being destructive. Now, he's also saying that Adam preyed upon, that he was against, that he was opposed to, that he plundered and spoiled living creatures, the Sama, whether they are those that walk about, you know, mammals and the like, winged creatures that fly, or even the fish of the sea. Is it we were abusive. We have become abusive. You know, there are enormous numbers of people that hunt not for food, just because they like killing. You know, we have lots of people that go out and duck hunt and quail hunt and pheasant hunt that don't eat the result. They just enjoy the killing. It's not something that God enjoys. He doesn't enjoy killing. So he's grieved that he has made humankind. You look at the religion of Islam, torturing animals is part and parcel of Islam. Muhammad did it, and Muslims follow his lead. So God has said, you know, if you're going to go out and just kill for the fun of it, if you're going to go torture that which the life that I have created, including your own, I'm not going to be part of it. Bad was so prevalent, so ubiquitous, and so pervasive, even God nearly lost hope. Elsewhere in his word, Yahweh tells us that his power, his energy and ability, and his capacity for mercy are infinite. Therefore, we must conclude that his patience, his willingness to continually witness evil, is limited, something he has told us. As such, we should again take note that Yahweh himself does not profess unending tolerance of that which corrupts and deceives his creation. Something to think about if you are religious. We'll return tomorrow.